Welcome to the AquariMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 83, recorded October 10th, 2011.
Greetings, everyone.
Hello.
First of all, we'd like to tell you about a fun experience that I just had today.
At the vet store.
Yeah.
And yes. that was our five-year-old in the back. She was there, too. I don't know if you could hear her. She said, so did I.
We were in the pet store trading in some assassin snails for some supplies. And one of the staff there showed us the Gararufa fish, also known as the pedicure fish or the doctor fish. They're the ones that are appearing in spas in many places where the aquarium is set up so that you can put your feet in there. And the fish will come and nibble on your feet and exfoliate your skin.
So it's a natural skin treatment that doesn't bear any chemicals or nastiness.
Right, and some people have mentioned that there might be health risks involved. Other people...
Well, if there's fish poop in the fish tank.
So there's, you know, there could possibly be some risks involved, maybe. And maybe those risks are overblown and maybe the benefits are overblown, whatever.
But hey, it's novel. It can't be any more risky than scary chemicals in a salon and inhaling all the smells from the chemicals.
Right. But I tend to believe that probably both the risks and benefits are overblown somewhat, but that's just me. I could be wrong. I don't have any empirical data to back up either one of those opinions. But it was cool. She said, why don't you try
your fingers in, didn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah. She said, why don't you try it? And we stuck our hands in. She made sure our hands, you know, asked us if they were... in the proper state, and we had said yes. And so we put our hands in there, and the fish started nibbling. And they it was really fun. They tickled. And that was all. They just tickled. Some people say, some of the people who use the fish in cosmetic situations, like in a spa, say that there's some sort of enzyme that the fish release that helps to keep your skin softer, and I don't know if that's true or not. You know, I have no way of confirming or denying that statement. But
hey,
fun.
It's novel.
Yes. And our daughter was so excited about it, she just asked if she could just leave her hand in there. Just permanently. She thought it was so fun. So, that was kind of a neat little experiment. There are many different species of gara fish, and a lot of them are showing up in pet stores. If you check fish base, there's like, I don't even know how many garas, but there are all kinds of them.
And they all do the skin exfoliating.
I'm not sure that all of them do. Apparently, Gararufa is the most famous one that does it, and
is it two words? So it's their scientific name,
right.
Is two words?
Garra space Rufa. A very interesting thing. They live in Turkey and other places where there are springs, warm springs, and they'll live in there. And that
so
they
not
naturally,
only do they exfoliate, but it's warm water.
Yeah.
That's nice.
But they're kind of a subtropical fish. They can live in cooler water, too. They can live in quite a few range, but they show up in these warm springs, and that's how it was discovered, because people would go to... you know, bask in the warmth of the spring or whatever, and the fish would come up and start doing that. That's how they discovered it.
Funny.
It's only become popular in spas in the, you know, last few years or so. But I don't know how many in the genus do it, but there are dozens and dozens and dozens, maybe 100 species of gara. So it was just fun to see. They just swam right up to our fingers immediately and began nibbling. Some people
said, "Hey, a snack."
Yeah, some people online I saw they were wondering whether the fish are only interested in nibbling on people because they're starving, and so they'll nibble on anything that's in there.
Do they not feed them in the spas?
Well, in the wild, I mean, when they go to these warm springs. But in the pet store, they feed the fish just fine, and they're
still
in with other fish, but they still did it. They were immediately attracted to our hands.
When there aren't people in the water, are they a cleaner kind of fish, like a Bristol's goes around and just gnaws on stuff all day?
They do nibble on rocks and things.
Grazers?
They like to chew on Aufwuchs.
On what?
That's the German word for the... algae and biofilm and tiny crustaceans that form on rocks and wood and things like that.
That's German for goo on the rocks.
Yeah, pretty much. That's you know, like...
fish walks into a bar.
There you go. So it was fun. Fun experience. Just thought I'd share.
That's pretty cool. Okay, we're going to go to Juliet in France.
Yes, Juliet with her cherry shrimp.
The continuing saga.
Yeah, she's got some good stuff.
Shrimp.
Some great stuff to share
finally
with us this
time. Some happy updates. It's good.
Yes, she said she just bought five from
cherry shrimp.
A place that had the right pH. We mentioned that, I think, in the last episode. Five additional shrimp. And they were in the same pH as her shrimp at home. So that's why she could get them, but no one knew in the shop where they had been until then. She got four buried females and one male, because she already had some males, and there was a juvenile swimming around in the bag that she found when she got home. And some of the females died after they released.
Still,
they released
after they released their eggs.
Right. And
did
the others are all doing
fine. They release
babies
or they release eggs? Tell me again.
They release babies.
Okay.
Yeah. Once the eggs are visible on their bellies, you know, they're carrying them, they're buried. That means they have been fertilized and are growing. And okay. So they release them as little happy
little
shrimp.
Little shrimpy things.
Yes. Not as larvae, as some shrimp release them as larvae, but...
Shrimplets,
them? Sure. That works well. I like that. And I think people have used that before. And she said they have also made it again, the ones that are surviving, and the two that died were in the middle of molting. And that's kind of a tough time for a shrimp, so that kind of makes sense. So she said this juvenile... the growth rate of this juvenile was amazing, doubled in size in only a week. And she'd never really carefully monitored the growth of the shrimp before, because having so many in a tank together, it's hard to say, oh, there's that one I saw 2 days ago.
Right.
Because, you know, there's too many.
It's not like you can tag them.
Right. And she says that sponge filters seemed to help, because they are always nibbling on sponge filters, you know, getting whatever little microorganisms are growing on there. Yeah. And it's...
instead of rock goo.
And it's no danger to them either, because it can't get sucked up in a sponge filter. So that seems to be helping. She says even if you cover one with pantyhose, the shrimp aren't sucked up to it. With the sponge filters, they're sucked up to it even less.
You cover the sponge filter with
pantyhose? No, if you cover another, like an
intake.
Yeah, an intake with pantyhose, which helps. But
and they still get sucked up?
Well, she's saying this works better.
The
sponge one works better, yeah. She says from those shrimp that she bought, it's less than 2 weeks, and she now has 20 babies.
Oh,
and
yay!
Jackson was wondering how many to get, and she's saying having, you know, that many babies from these few shrimp. And starting the first time she started, she had two males and one female and had 50 in 4 months.
Wow.
And that was being housed with a male beta who probably ate.
Several of them.
Yes. She said this time they're housed alone and their breeding rate is tremendous. And since in France, where she is at least, they pay about €5 a shrimp. Isn't that something like
$10? How much is a euro to...
I don't know exactly, but I think it's somewhere near $10. So.
Per shrimp?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a lot. So that would be really expensive for us in our area. And luckily, we don't have to pay that much, but I would never buy 20 shrimp if I had to pay that much. The only reason why
That's how much she bought them for. Oh, I thought you said that's how much the pet store will take them for if she sells them back to the pet store.
No, they have to pay that much.
Wow.
Here, the most I've ever seen them for a sale in a store is probably about $3. And they're often cheaper than that. It depends, but anyway,
I
guess
it's just harder to get?
Depends on your area and your local fish store and all kinds of things. I'm not sure exactly. You know, it probably varies a lot over different pet stores in different areas and things like that. But yeah, I would never want to start with that many. I would never start with even 12. The only reason I recommended that is because when you buy them from a pet store, you're likely to have a situation where the shrimp are probably closely related. And so starting out with a fairly large number is probably good because...
Genetically speaking,
you get a little more variety to start with. If you just start with just a few... You know, eventually that's going to it's going to make for less genetic diversity, which is not as bad as people think. I mean, you're not going to get mutated, you know, two-headed shrimp or anything.
You might get shrimp with mutant powers, though. That would be cool.
Pretty unlikely, though. It's probably not going to be a great issue, but, you know, some people have noticed that certain shrimp varieties that are heavily, they're very popular and overbred, the inbreeding can be a problem and reduce hardiness. So just... That was my main reason for suggesting that many, because certainly they are very prolific.
So it's better for the fish genetically, ecumenically...
Grammatically.
Nice hat.
So, she also mentions, and this is another great point for Jackson, who's, you know, getting into the cherry shrimp, that she has kept them in a community tank with two gouramis, Cory cats, and coolie loaches. She said no babies ever survived in those conditions.
Right.
And she's not sure which fish were the biggest culprits, but she's pretty sure the coolies and the corys just hoovered them up. And I don't doubt it.
That's a good way to hoovered them.
Yeah.
I like that.
And she said her gouramis eat anything they can fit in their mouths, they can slide into small crevices, and they always eat a lot of her endlers' babies.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So she's pretty sure shrimp wouldn't last with them.
Naughty gouramis.
And it does depend a lot on the gouramis. I mean, there are a lot of different gouramis in the hubby, but I tend to think that, you know, and I think I mentioned in the last show, shrimp do better by themselves without fish. And I'm glad that Juliet is pointing this out too and giving some specific reasons why that's mm-hmm. true. I've had quarry cats. I've seen them suck up newly molted adults like candy, just slurp, wow. gone.
Shrimp on a stick.
Yeah, and these are quarries, which are, you know, pretty gentle little fish. Uh-huh. But I had some Corydoras peliatus, I think it was. I saw one that had recently molted. They were chasing it around and then just slurp, it was gone.
Wow.
And I've seen neons do the same thing. Neon tetras. When they molt, they're really vulnerable. But the babies, of course, are vulnerable all the time.
Because they're so small.
Another great point that Juliet mentions is that should be taken into account is that fish, they do cause stress. They inflict stress on the shrimp. And that the shrimp behave totally
differently. You mean other than eating them?
Right. Well, other than eating them, yeah. Yeah, that's a good thing to bring up. But yeah, she said they behave totally differently when they're housed alone without fish. And I agree. I've seen it.
Because they're not hiding.
Yeah. Yeah, she says if you want to see them out and about and active, they should not be kept with any fish at all, no matter what size.
Okay.
She said when they had two young endlers in a tank that she had put in there. These were tiny young endlers, and endlers don't get very big anyway,
right.
especially not the males.
And she said the shrimps still weren't happy.
No, she said they were hiding from them, and she did it to help control an algae bloom that was in the tank, and that, because endlers are so good at it, they're really good at taking care of hair algae in her experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they just tear the strands right off, which is really nice because there's not a lot of fish that'll do that. But she said they sense the presence of the fish no matter how many or what size, and they begin to hide. And so that's why she houses them alone. So that's some good food for thought, Jackson, there. And she says even endlers, you know, they're teeny like guppies and they'll eat baby shrimp.
Right.
So it's not just size when you're thinking about which fish to keep them with. That's a good, great point. And she's also going to set up a different tank with different pH if she wants to try cardinal shrimp.
What would cardinal shrimp look like?
Oh, they're amazing. There are some of those Sulawesi Island shrimp.
Where's the Sulawesi Islands?
Over by Indonesia somewhere. Mm. I'm not exactly sure. I
Do
sound
they have
dumb
a
when I say
different
that.
Color pattern?
Or? Yes, they're very, very red.
Mm-hmm.
Cardinal red with white spots.
And
white,
that would be pretty.
White, they're chelipeds, their first pair of chelipeds, uh-huh. and maybe the second pair, white too.
Nice.
Very beautiful. Extremely beautiful shrimp. They're not as easy to take care of as some others. They're not nearly as easy as red cherry shrimp, but she says she's going to run a tank for at least 3 months before she introduces them. That's good, and I'm mm-hmm. certain she means a planted tank. I'm certain, because that's what you want to do. And she said, shrimp hate new tanks, and having had problems with the simple cherry shrimp, I want to be extra careful with any new species. So
right.
that's a good point. So, I would say, in summary, Juliet has some great points, reasons why you should keep shrimp alone and why they do the best alone. And I totally agree with that. Jackson was determined to experiment, and I think, you know, that's if he wants to do that and he understands the risks involved, that's great. But these are some great reasons to consider just keeping them alone. All right. Now, actually, and strangely, Juliet was our only... Oh, we forgot to mention Juliet's from France. So thanks again, Juliet, for
Oh, I thought I said that. I thought we were going to Juliet in France.
Maybe you did. I forgot to.
That's
so
okay.
If you did it, then we're fine. But thank you, Juliet. She's our only contributor for today. Can you believe that?
Wow.
So there's plenty of space, folks. Chime in. There's a lull. our message machine is waiting, and we're waiting. Email, Facebook,
mm-hmm.
Our message, whatever.
We're here for you.
So give us a call or send us a message. We're ready. But today I would like to mention some other things. I'd like to talk about algae a bit.
Algae.
Okay, this is what prompted this discussion, okay?
Tell us.
I have noticed at work, and maybe I mentioned this, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I have mentioned it, but at work I have a 5-gallon tank with a couple of African dwarf frogs in it.
Mm-hmm.
And some cherry shrimp, which are breeding, although not breeding very fast because they're in with the frogs,
right.
but there's a small, fairly constant population that hovers somewhere around 10 or 12.
Okay.
And I've got those in there in an olive nerite, okay?
Uh-huh.
And it's a planted tank.
What plants do you have?
I've got Java moss and some Java fern and some Anubias, and that's about it.
Okay.
You know, it's a fairly low maintenance tank, no CO2 or anything like that, but I do use Flourish Excel and some other nutrients. Anyway, this tank looks really clear. I don't have a whole lot of algae visible or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But up in the, well, down, I guess, in the bottom left corner there is a little ceramic dish that I use for feeding the frogs in. And there is a portion of the dish which gets close enough to the glass. It's about a millimeter, millimeter and a half, or something like that, from the glass.
Mm-hmm.
Close enough to the glass that the olive nearite can't get down there. And none of the bigger shrimp can. Maybe some of the little teeny shrimplets can get down there, but that's it. Okay? So, right up there, there's a patch of algae growing on the glass. Everywhere else, the glass looks perfectly clear.
Because they can't get to it to
clean.
Eat it.
Right. So, the algae crew in the tank is really doing a great job keeping that algae clear. I don't have to, you know, scrub off algae or anything. They do it. And, except for this little patch, which is about maybe an inch and a half long and maybe half an inch tall, where this container is close. Up against the side. And one of my coworkers was looking at that the other day, and he was looking at my tank, and he has a tank. He's a fairly new to the hobby, but he's very interested, and he often has some great questions to ask me. So
before we find out more, though, perhaps we should take our break.
Okay.
This isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There, that wasn't so painful now, was it?
So basically, I just thought it would be a good idea to talk about algae and how to deal with it and so on, because there are a lot of fallacies out there about algae
mm-hmm.
and how it should be dealt with and so on. There are effective ways to deal with it. There are less effective ways to deal with it. There are
non-effective ways to deal with it.
There are multi-pronged approaches. And so I thought I'd just talk about that. I think the example I gave was illustrative of balance to some extent, so that we had several factors keeping the algae under control, and then removing one of those factors from that little patch of glass showed what state it would be in if we didn't have all of those factors acting
right.
together. And so, basically, to maintain this balance, you have to accept certain facts of life. One of them is, if there are aquatic creatures in water, there are nutrients in the water that algae can use. Now, you can minimize them. You can do other things to control them, you know. But basically, if you have some sort of creature living in water, there's the potential for algae to use those nutrients, utilize them to grow. Another thing is that algal spores, depending on how you want to pronounce that, they end up almost everywhere. Some of them can be airborne. They can be introduced with water you get from a pet store, or they can even be reproducing at low invisible concentrations, basically. You have algae in a tank where conditions aren't particularly conducive to a certain algae doing well, but it can still reproduce at very small quantities, and then as soon as the conditions get to the point where it could do well, it does. And so, basically, potential for algae exists. It's going to find its way in to almost any aquarium.
There is light and there are nutrients. Algae will find its way.
Yes. Yes. So, that doesn't mean that it's going to grow rampant or even be a problem or even be particularly noticeable necessarily, but it can be depending on the situation. So, to make sure algae stays within acceptable bounds, one thing is to control the light that is available to algae. There are a lot of ways to do that. Some people reduce the photo period. They just keep their lights on for less time. Some people split the photo period in an attempt to control algae.
Split it.
So they might have their lights on from, say, 8 in the morning until noon, and then have it off for 3 hours, and then turn it back on at 3 until 6 or whatever.
And so why is that bad for the algae? Why does that make it not grow?
Some people think that because higher plants can store food for longer, that splitting the photo period is bad for algae. I don't know if that's true or not, but some people seem to report some success with that.
Okay.
But basically, managing your photo period is important. There are tanks that would not grow a whole lot of algae, but people just keep them on too long, keep the light on all the time or too long, and then it grows too much. So being conscious of that, you know, something between 10 and 12 hours depending on your system. Having your light on can be good, and also depends on whether or not you have a planted tank, and we'll get into that later. But you can also shade the water with aquatic plants that grow at the surface, which reduces the light available to the
not
algae.
Not as much light filters down through to the algae.
Right, but that's not the most important thing the plants do, but we'll get to that later as well. And you can also just reduce the amount of light reaching the water. Think about, you know, are you having direct sunlight that's hitting the aquarium for a certain period each day?
Like if it's next to a window.
Right, that can also have a big effect. Exactly. Now, basic aquarium kits that you get, you know, the shop lighting comes, the stock lighting, not shop lighting, but stock lighting, comes with a basic aquarium kit. They usually try to keep the light fairly low. It's enough to see your fish, but it's not enough to grow tons of different types of algae crazily. Some types will still thrive in that light.
It's usually not enough to grow a lot of plants either.
No, but it's most plants, you know, there are low-light plants that can do okay with that. But that's the approach that they take, is just by reducing the amount of light. Because you could make a really bright light in an aquarium like that, and you could see the fish really well, and they would sparkle, but then soon algae would take a foothold and grow like crazy. So that's their reasoning behind that. Although sometimes reducing the light can be as good as a temporary solution, because algae, like I was saying before, can't store food nearly as long as plants can. So sometimes people will black out their tank. They'll cover it with something so that no light gets in.
Then you can't see your fish.
For several days. Well, they do it just for several days. Maybe 3 or 4 days.
To try to kill off the algae?
To try to help kill off the algae. It's kind of an aggressive algae control regimen.
Weed block.
Yeah, it's sort of like that. And it can be helpful in certain situations. And then the plants are more likely, they can store food. You know, they have a bigger body and they have more, I guess you could say, advanced storage ability. And so they do better. There is a problem with the general strategy of reducing light levels. There's still some algae that can thrive in fairly low light. And so you can still have problems with those types of algae.
And not get to see your fish.
Not get to see your fish as well, and so on. So there another strategy you could use, I guess, is to remove the algae itself from the aquarium. There are several ways to do that. One of them is with chemicals, with algicides. I don't like using algicides myself, particularly.
We don't particularly like using anything with the word part, side, on
like
the
pesticides,
end.
Herbicides, insecticides. Yeah, I don't really like using any of those. But part of the problem is that algicides can damage plant life. Some of them say right on the label, will not harm fish, will not harm plants, but some of them do anyway. I'm not going to mention any specific brands, but I don't like to use them for that reason, and because they are a pesticide.
Scary chemicals.
Right. And another issue with them is that sometimes you can use one to control an outbreak of algae, but then you're really not taking care of the root of the problem, and
it's
so you're
symptomatic.
Probably going to get another one with the same type of algae, likely enough, if your conditions haven't changed, and then it might have developed some immunity to the algicide.
It's like it's super algae instead of super bugs.
Right, and so that's not a very good thing either.
No.
Some things, though, here's a chemical control that I do use, but I don't really specifically use it for algae so much. But Flourish Excel, made by Seachem.
And that's a fertilizer, isn't it?
It is. It's a carbon source, basically.
Okay.
It's the Flourish line of products includes all kinds of fertilizers, but Flourish Excel, specifically, is a carbon source. In liquid form, it's diglyceraldehyde, I think. And this substance makes carbon available to plants. It contains carbon chains that are similar to what they do after they photosynthesize to fix carbon from, you know, the water column. And it also happens to be damaging to lots of different kinds of algae.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And algae doesn't like carbon?
Well, algae needs carbon. Algae needs carbon. But in this particular chemical form, apparently it can sometimes hurt algae. And some people will take it and just squirt it directly onto problem areas on the plants and it will help. Or just regular use, dosing it in the aquarium, which benefits the plants, can also do that. And, of course, indirectly by benefiting the plants, you're also taking nutrients away from the algae. So there are some people who use that. So if you're interested in that, you can read up on that. Of course, a UV sterilizer is great for killing suspended microalgae that's just floating around in the water, like green water. A nice UV sterilizer can, you know, clear up an infestation of that. You still have the idea or the situation that you're treating the symptoms, but the root of the problem still exists.
It'll still come back.
Right, in both of those cases. You can remove it with elbow grease. You know, I'm a believer in a good algae scraper once in a while, because not every single bit of algae necessarily will be removed from the glass where you want it to be removed from, especially if you're going to take pictures or something of your aquarium. Right. You want to do some algae scraping. Even if most of it gets taken care of through other means, it might be a little, and just cosmetically you want to remove it, even if it's not a particular problem, other than just cosmetically. And then an algae crew, which is one of my favorite ways of handling algae. Because some people think about this. There are two extremes when you're talking about an algae crew. Some people say, an algae crew will handle every speck of algae in every situation, so just get the right algae crew, and you'll be fine. I tend to be a little bit closer to that end. If you get the right algae crew, you can handle most algae problems, but they won't necessarily remove every single speck of algae in the aquarium, but they'll certainly reduce it to an aesthetically pleasing level if you do it right. And then there are other people who say, well, algae crews are pointless because if you get an algae crew, what you're doing is introducing more organisms into the system, which will produce waste, which will cause more algae to grow, which is true. But at the same time, if they're eating enough of that algae, then they may be keeping it to a level that is tolerable, just like I'm talking about my tank at work. I have an algae crew in there, and they're obviously handling the algae to a satisfactory level. And they are also producing waste that is feeding that algae. It's true.
But it's also feeding the other plants.
Right. It's also feeding the other plants, and they're keeping on top of the algae. And so there's a balance where it's an aesthetically pleasing level. Of course, it's not just an algae crew. You need more than an algae crew to take care of algae. But it can be an effective tool in your arsenal against algae problems. Let's say it that way. So, yeah, an algae crew is great. It's not the only solution. You can't get along with just an algae crew necessarily. You still need to think about other things and use other measures to keep algae under control. But a good algae crew is a great asset. Then, finally, and I think this is the most important, if you had to just pick one means of controlling algae, is to reduce the nutrients available to algae. There are several ways to do that. One is to remove them through chemical means, like resins that absorb phosphate. Algae use phosphate as a nutrient. If you put in a phosphate-absorbing resin in your filter, and it absorbs all the available phosphate from the water column, and there isn't any for the algae to use,
algae starves.
Then effectively you can control algae to some extent. Not my favorite way of controlling algae for several reasons. One, because if you absorb all the phosphate from the water, then you can't really grow other plants that also need phosphate.
But if you don't have a planted tank?
If you don't have a planted tank, it can be one way to do it. Another way is that those phosphate-absorbing resins cost money, and you have to keep replacing them.
Right.
It's another reason. But there, you know, it has their place in certain cases, but not my favorite way of doing it, but it can be a tool. Another one, and I think this is one of my top two ways of controlling algae ever, besides algae crews, because they're fun by themselves, just interesting, is just partial water changes. You're reducing diluting nutrients available to algae through partial water changes. They're not going to do it necessarily by themselves. If you're just using partial water changes, you know, there are going to be some nutrients, measurable nutrients, in the water almost all the time. And depending on your water supply, you could be putting algae nutrients back into your tank. If you have high nitrates in your water, for example, you could be feeding algae by doing a water change. So not the only thing to be considering, but it can do...
Helpful along with other strategies.
Right, helpful along with other strategies, and important anyway for other reasons, so you should always do your partial water changes, and that helps. And then finally, removing them through plant biomass. Okay, if you have healthy growing plants in large quantities in an aquarium, they're going to be constantly filtering out everything that algae likes. Nitrates, or ammonia, depending on various factors. It could be just straight ammonia before it even becomes nitrate. Phosphates, iron, they're going to be, you know, using all these different nutrients, taking them straight out of the water, converting them into plant biomass.
To outcompete the algae is what you want.
Right. And as long as the plants are happy, they have enough CO2, they have enough light and enough all these nutrients, you can keep the algae under control by keeping the plants happy. Sometimes, you know, I think if you're going to use plants, you will probably also need an algae crew, because there are certain types of algae. There's one type called staghorn algae. Mm-hmm. If all the plants are doing well, the nitrates are fairly low in the tank and everything, because the plants are absorbing almost all of them and things are working well, staghorn algae can still show up, especially in places with high flow and high light, like right by your filter outflow, up near the surface of the water on the tips of leaves. It can show up. But if you've got enough shrimp and fish that'll eat that, then you're good.
Covered.
So, I guess in summary today, there are several ways to control algae.
Balance, Daniel.
Yes, balance is very important. Make sure that you don't rely on just one means of controlling algae, and you should do well.
Words to live by.
Yeah, and just one or two plants in the corner of the tank that aren't doing so hot, that's not going to do anything against algae. The algae will cover them, and they'll be buried under mounds and mountains of algae.
You need an army of plants.
You need to have a lot of healthy, fairly fast-growing plants to really take care of it.
Which most of those we've done podcasts on back at the beginning, haven't we?
Yes, a lot of
more specific plants.
A lot of basic plants we've done those on. Yep. Okay. Well, may the fish be with you.
Bye, folks.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-801-801.